All right, welcome back. Episode 61, Picker's Market.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a while since all four of us have been even in a room together.
Yeah.
Lisa's been gone for 2 weeks. Keith and I were gone. And then we had some work from home stuff yesterday and Monday. And
all good.
It's probably been over 3 weeks.
Yeah, it's probably been almost a month since all four of us.
Dang.
Lucky listeners, we're all back.
How's everybody doing?
Good.
Yeah. Kyle?
Pretty good.
Yeah. Lisa?
All good.
You look all refreshed from your long vacation.
Yes,
good for you.
I am. Good to see you all again.
She didn't have to sit next to me for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's
three. That was part of it.
Three. Yeah.
It's all the new Aperol spritzes or what was the one you're talking about? Blood orange?
The Sarti spritz. That's a new trend.
Right.
The new European it drink.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Perfect.
I have to do a taste.
Can you get it here at like restaurants in the U.S.?
Yeah, I have to do more research on that. But if it is the case, we will have to do some
testing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. All right. Let's get to the three truths and a lie. Since Lisa added one last week, right? So we've got four options now.
What?
Okay. So since it's episode 61, there are exactly 61 moons orbiting the planet Jupiter. Route 61 in the U.S. is nicknamed the Blues Highway. Roger Maris hit 61 home runs in 1961, breaking Babe Ruth's single-season record at the time. And the 61st element on the periodic table is named after the Greek god Hermes, however you want to pronounce that.
Hermes.
Yeah.
Wow. Lisa, you want to go first in this one since you started this new trend of adding...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I couldn't decide last week, so I was like, why not adding another one? Well, so I have no idea about any of those, to be honest. The second one I can see, that Route 61 is the Blues Highway. I can see that. The element, I don't know. 61 moons, I don't know either. I would say C is wrong because 61 home runs in 1961, that seems too much of a coincidence for me. So I go with that.
Cam?
Kyle?
Hmm. I default to C when I don't know. So I'm going
to test taking days. Mm-hmm. You're going C as well?
Yep, I am.
Moons, I have no idea, but I was going to go C, but I can't have all three of us going C as well. I think it's like 61 and 62 or something. I think that's the problem with that one. But since you two already have that one covered, who knows about this periodic table? We have to get rid of that one.
Mm-hmm. That's,
no one knows that. I'm going to go just off, just pure guess, which I'm going A, moons.
It is A.
Mm. Oh.
There's actually 90 observed moons around Jupiter.
That's how you guess on test.
Can you name all of them?
Name what?
The moons.
I don't know that they
90.
Do they name the moons?
Keith knows a song about them. He can do all 90.
I know it's a wax on, wax off, my kids.
Right.
Circling to your kids on that one, Kyle, the moon song.
No, is there
it's
a moon
like
song?
It's like elementary school. My kids sing it every once in a while. I'll just shake my head.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'll have to maybe bring a little clip of that next week for us.
All right. So Keith and I last week, we were at, and I guess I'll throw a binger in there too, but we were at what we call Gradient Gala.
Yep.
So I guess, Keith, if you want to just give a quick.
Yeah, it's a rewards trip for our top 200 advisors. And they bring their families, which is, I think, the best part of it. And I think there's over 500 people between Gradient employees, those 200 advisors, and their families. We went to Quebec. Usually these events, we have a gala and then a grand gala, which is later in the summer. So it's, the top 200 and then top 25. It's kind of the breakdown. It's fantastic. They do a small business meeting I presented, on Great Investments for 15 minutes, which is, that's enough in that kind of venue. So it was good because people are there to have a good time, meet families. And that's what I appreciate. I bring my wife, you went solo this year, but it's nice because then they get to meet your family as well. And you kind of make bigger connections. And it's a good event. It's in Quebec. It's the first time I've ever been to Quebec. Thought it was a beautiful city. Great walking, great history. Felt like you're in Europe without going to Europe. Only issue had it, I think there was no directs from Minneapolis and a lot of cities.
It was
so it was a little hard to get to and get back from. That and the weather was kind of subpar for
a 3-hour total flight turned into a full day of travel.
It was kind of crazy. It was
pretty bad.
What were your thoughts on it? Because that's your first one.
It was my first one that I went to. And it's different, right? Like, and I think it'll be different if, you know, it's at a resort versus like in the middle of a city, because me being solo, you know, trying to find advisors to go mingle and and hang out with or whatever, but everybody just went off and kind of did their own thing. And so, you know, I ended up working during the days a little bit rather than, you know, just because everybody's not there. So you can't find anybody.
Yeah. So I think some people really appreciate the fact they can just kind of slip in, you know, from the visor base, that they can slip into the, because it's a vacation for them as well. So they like that. And then I think the pros and cons is, like you said, if you were looking for some advisors to talk to, it's like, it's not a resort where you'd run into them, because all of a sudden they could be wandering around the city.
Yeah.
So Events and Travel did a fantastic job. They always pick a great location, great activities. They had a Cirque du Soleil.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. Yeah. They had a Bridgerton evening, which is kind of fun. They had everybody dresses up in costume. So top notch. I think the advisors absolutely love it.
Well, it was nice, because I don't know that I would just like go to Quebec City for a vacation either. So it was kind of nice to go on that and just see it. And because it was a beautiful city, like a little restaurants and shops and different things to do. So
felt like
it was,
Europe.
It was for sure. Yep. But then it's funny, because then you go like 5 minutes outside of like that old Quebec city, and it's like normal,
just like a normal city
suburb.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for sure.
But all right, we'll get to a hot button. We'll get Kyle and Lisa included on this podcast at some point. So, you know, I want to keep this apolitical, but U.S., Iran, Israel, right? I think that's the big hot topic over the weekend. U.S. officially bombed three nuclear sites in Iran, and now we have a potent, I guess we are in a ceasefire at this point. We'll see if that holds. But I want your guys' initial reaction on that Saturday, Sunday, when you guys heard about it. What was your initial thought on what the markets were going to be doing?
Go ahead, Lisa and Kyle.
Well, I saw that and I was like, well, that's going to be a fun Monday. And I would have lost a lot of money betting on if the market opened red or green and what the oil markets are doing. So I was really surprised, and I was like, okay, like what is going on? Like completely opposite reaction of what I thought to myself on the weekend when I saw this. Yeah, quite interesting.
Kyle, similar reaction or different?
Yeah, no, pretty similar. I mean, I thought oil was going to be spiking, and I looked at Bloomberg, and it sure enough was initially.
Initially, yeah.
Right. But then come Monday morning, it completely inverted, just completely unwound. So I mean, it is interesting, because you look back at some of the other like geopolitical issues. I mean, we've had a bunch of them, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, in a couple minutes. But it's expectations versus reality, right? It's almost like what works in a market with that kind of volatility, like how big of a magnitude of an issue does it need to be to actually drag markets down? There was an interesting piece at my old shop about geopolitical risks or whatever. And historically, the markets are always usually up very shortly after a big, like conflicts over the last 100 years. It's always usually like within, you know, a month, it's always green markets pretty much through and through. So it's,
I guess, the
counterintuitive.
Well, but if you think about it, the risk is now, or the potential overhang is now gone.
Right.
If you think about it.
Yeah. People don't like uncertainty.
Yeah.
And now it's certain.
So like, if you're uncertain, if US was going to bomb Iran, they finally did it.
Right.
Now that risk is gone, I guess. I don't know, Keith, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's weird. I do think, generally speaking, when in these conflicts, the market investors are starting to just kind of not ignore them, but kind of to the point of history, if you wait a few weeks, it's usually a sell off and then a correction. I think the market's just moving that sell off to, we really weren't not going to sell off, and it will look at fundamentals. Now, one thing that does surprise me, I'm not sure we'll talk about later, is oil. I get that it was maybe, you know, the initial over the weekend, if you look at futures, it was spiking up. I thought, okay, maybe it'd be up a little bit or flattish. I wasn't expecting, because they didn't really bomb any of the necessarily the oil sites. I think that would have been a bigger problem.
Yeah.
So that was one thought. And then, but what surprised me is then also, I think oil finished down 5%. And then I think yesterday it followed down with another almost 5%. So it's like, we're down 10% from the weekend. So we basically had, you know, us bombing Iran, probably a truce, at least for the time being, and oil's, you know, down 10% in a matter of a couple of days. So it's like, what was the market expecting prior to the bombing of the nuclear, which I don't think anybody expected that. So mm-hmm. it's like, was the market really expecting something worse than that to be the price of oil? That's
what I mean, it must have been. I mean, if you think about it, it's like the Strait of Hormuz, you know, so much oil goes through there.
Yeah, and, what, 20%?
Yeah, most of that doesn't even come to the U.S. It's mostly to China.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you look at a lot of the U.S. producers like Occidental Petroleum or EOG or, you know, like Diamondback or, you know, any of those kind of more localized producers mm-hmm. that aren't the big integrateds, they were all like big down.
Yeah.
Big down days for the last couple of days. So it seems like embedded expectations were, I don't know what they were. It's just,
it just surprised me that I wouldn't expect it. I don't think I heard anybody ever saying that the U.S. is so close to bombing Iran. So I would expect it at least a little bit of a knee jerk reaction mm-hmm. of like, okay, if that's it, then all of a sudden the oil fields are going to get hit. And this is even before the truce got announced.
Well, okay. But what about on the geopolitical side, right? So like there was really nobody came out in support of Iran, right? They condemned the bombing, mm-hmm. but then no one really came out to say, yeah, we'll back Iran for anything. Mm-hmm. So if they do retaliate, we'll join, right? So maybe that was part of it. Like nobody, it wasn't going to escalate to a broader war because Iran, there's no way Iran can compete with the U.S. military. I mean, just the seven B-2 bombers we sent over there are basically the military budget of Iran mm-hmm. put together, right? Yeah. So like, maybe the market just said this isn't going to turn into a broader conflict and we're okay with what mm-hmm. happened and move on. And
that must be it, why oil is down. But I still kind of question. But I mean, they didn't, because anything like could spill, Hossa, anything they didn't spill bomb over. Any,
but they didn't do anything to the oil facilities.
Infrastructure, yeah,
right?
I get that. So, but the straits are, you know, Hormuz, it's 20% that go through there that it's not like now they probably won't touch, at least underneath the
well, yeah. So to add on to that, the day later, they came out and said that they were thinking about closing that down, which I think then you might see mm-hmm. something happen with oil. Yeah. 20% of your supply goes offline. I mean, even though most of it goes to China, you still need to mm-hmm. source it from somewhere.
Well, part of it too, though, is because, I mean, that they don't control both sides of that strait, though, right?
No, they would have to basically attack ships going through. And
right. Yeah, because the other side is what, UAE, mm-hmm. right? It's on the other side of it. Yeah, so, I mean, there's a vested interest to
keep it going.
Keep it going, I would, you know, so.
Yeah. But, okay, so let me ask you guys this. So does geopolitical risk really matter anymore? Because it certainly doesn't feel like it matters because you have Russia-Ukraine, right? That certainly hasn't made any impact. You've had Israel-Hamas going on since October of last year, mm-hmm. really hasn't done anything. And now we have this Israel-Iran / kind of U.S. and doesn't seem to be doing anything. So do we just look past any geopolitical conflict at this point and say everything eventually will be all good and just get over it?
Yeah, I mean, I would say a couple things come to my mind. The first would be timing, right? Like it's really easy years after the fact to look at a chart and see the tiny squiggles mm-hmm. and be like, ah. I mean, you know, Binger does that RIAU. He has the earnings yep. chart or whatever, and he's like, his comment was, oh yeah, during COVID you could see the one teeny down, you know, GDP contraction or whatever, and it's like, oh, didn't really make a difference, you know, off we go. So that being said, in the time, if you compress it to just, you know, October 7th, the markets were down, and they were down, you know, double digit, I think, over the course of the week, and they rebounded, you know, a fairly quick amount. But I think so. Time is one thing, and maybe that goes back to just the clients and advisor base to say, okay, you're not day trading here.
Yeah.
Being patient and time arbitrage, time in the market's more valuable than timing the market, right? So that would be one key takeaway, right? Things will work themselves out over time. And then the other would be sector rotations come to mind. So if you look at like October 7th, one great example would be the lead up to that for a year with the defense primes. So Lockheed Martin, Raytheon or RTX, L3Harris, General Dynamic, Huntington Ingalls, Northrop Grumman, all those companies had severely underperformed for a year going into that. Mm-hmm. They were like very, very strong underperformers. October 7th happens and it was a complete reset on that industry group. And then they saw about a year of outperformance and then now it's come back off and, you know, geopolitical kind of tides change. And now you're seeing sector, you know, or I guess industry leadership with those again. So, so I don't know if that is helpful in framing the context of the way I'm thinking about it, but yeah, it's more like time in the market, being prudent, long-term, you know, stewards of the investments, and then also taking tactical opportunities when they present themselves, I think are two strategies to mm-hmm. think about in the context of geopolitical risk.
Lisa?
Yeah, I think to Kyle's point, there's some form of desensitization among investors and people because we had that so close together, like Russia, Ukraine, Hamas, Israel, and now the latest one in the Middle East. So I think investors are used to constantly hear about that, geopolitics, escalations, constantly are surrounded by that. It's pretty recent in their memory what the markets did because all three escalations were pretty close together. And I think you mentioned that before with the research paper. I saw some, it might have been the same, from Deutsche Bank, mm-hmm. which they say, and kind of was even before World War II, that in the 3 weeks following an escalation, market react negatively, but in the subsequent 3 weeks, they rebound or even are better off than mm-hmm. before. And so I think investors kind of have that in their memory and know that and can sit it out and can watch it a little bit more from afar than reacting too strong to it. I would say that plays into it.
Keith, you've been in the business the longest, so
thanks for calling me the old guy again.
Well, I'm
he didn't deny it.
No.
Right now, do these conflicts, do they feel different than ones that have happened in the past? Or is it kind of the same and it's just...
I think it's kind of the same. I think all you guys' points are valid. I think part of it's people are getting desensitized to it. I think the other thing is people do look at history as a guide and say, a month later, now markets are going to be up. So if I'm a smart investor, they'll kind of... You're compressing that time frame. I think it's just because of information is so much quicker. I mean, the one thing that we have to worry about at some point in time, it's all, you know, investments about probability, outcomes, and things like that. So, you know, historically before, you're kind of had a longer probability of things dragging on, and maybe people are shrinking that, saying it's going to be shorter, less impactful. We just have to be a little careful if all of a sudden one of these starts to spin out of control, that I think that's where it really surprised the market. So mm-hmm. just keep that in the back of everybody's mind. But I do think, generally speaking, the market does a good job of discounting the impact. And Kyle definitely mentioned that you see sector rotation. I mean, so at the top level, it doesn't look like, you know, if we look at the chart, not a whole lot's going on up and to the right, which is what we like. But underneath, you know, defense stocks, especially you mentioned the U.S. ones, but European ones, you know, Tyler, you probably owned some mm-hmm. in the past and they're the G40i is those stocks have been absolutely home runs from recently just mm-hmm. because of all the money that, you know, the U.S. says they're not contributing as much to NATO. Also in the European countries, you need to start chipping in. That's a huge benefit for mm-hmm. those, you know, mm-hmm. primes and contractors over there. So I think there's opportunities for us as investors to kind of find if these situations arise. And that's what we look at at the end of the day, right? We're investing in companies and this geopolitical has impacts. We just, you know, I think we were a lot more leery of it, you know, historically. I think we're becoming less of it just because of other reasons that history shows it's actually a good time to be investing. If you're a patient investor, time in the market's more than, you know, trying to time the market. So at the end of the day, you know, if some people get confused, it's maybe just take a deep breath and just kind of watch what's going on. Yeah. And in the end result, you're usually better off that way.
The other thing that I've been thinking about on this is it almost feels like as long as these stay regional conflicts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't start to get the what I'd call the big boys into the mm-hmm. mix, like mm-hmm. US, China, mm-hmm. Your India's, your, I mean, Russia's in a regional conflict, but as long as like the big military countries don't start to get too involved mm-hmm. and start backing one side or the other, I feel like the market doesn't have to worry too much because these countries are so small and minimal on the global scale, right? So like I remember when Russia invaded Ukraine, within all the US ETFs, they wrote their Russian assets down to zero. Mm-hmm. And when Russia's a 0.2% of an ETF, like it's a minimal impact, yeah. right? So that's the other part that I think about it is as long as these just stay regional, there's not a big impact. I mean, the 20% oil mm-hmm. thing could be a big impact if they close the strait, but like generally speaking,
yeah,
Iran's GDP doesn't make up a whole lot of the global GDP.
I totally agree with that. The one thing that comes to the back of my mind is how quickly something like that can escalate, though, because yeah. like World War One literally started with a, you know, assassination in yeah. Serbia.
Yeah.
And these, you know, kind of defensive intermingling of policy, legal, regulatory, all these kind of partnerships that these little countries may or may not have can cause knock-on yeah. effects to happen and cascade. So, you know, one thing that's, since we're talking about geopolitical, you know, Taiwan, it's mm-hmm. there, it exists, it's been a hot button issue for a while now, and you've seen, you know, record numbers of sorties from China going, you know, over the island and around and doing that kind of thing. And you know, Japan right there, you've had, I mean, I remember when I started doing securities analysis, the 9-dash line in the Chinese, mm-hmm. you know, in the South China Sea, that was like a big thing. And Japan and China were fighting along with the Philippines and Malaysia and other countries over these waterways. And that just seems like a flash in the pan, right? Like it was a big thing in the news for a little bit in the kind of 2009, 10, 11. And it got hot enough where on mainland China, they were actually burning Japanese car dealerships because of these issues. And you think about that issue and you're like, ah, oh, it's not that big of a deal. But if that conflict were to escalate between those two powers, I don't think most Americans realize, like from World War II, Japan in their constitution was demilitarized and the US is their protector, right? So if something happens where, you know, a conflict were to arise between those two powers, with or without Taiwan, whatever, like the US might be drawn legally into a battle they might not be anticipating. Mm-hmm. And people don't really realize that because you're like, oh, well, why is that our conflict? Because, you know,
yeah.
80 years ago, we did this thing, right? So where we inked a deal to, you know, to end a prior war. So it is interesting that looking at some of those things where they might be small today, mm-hmm. but just keeping an eye on yeah. it. And I think, Keith, your point on like the black swan, where mm-hmm. it's like, what would it take for something like that to happen? That's probably the way to catch most people by surprise.
Yeah, that's it. And I think oil is so important from, you know, geopolitical, because that's, we talk about how, you know, it goes in everything. It's a cost. So when mm-hmm. oil went up, that was my fear. I think that was kind of the silent kind of benefit of the market this year that no one's talked about is oil prices coming down gradually. Mm-hmm. And then we hit, you know, $60, $65 and all of a sudden this conflict starting to Israel, Iran, other stuff in the Middle East starting to heat up. All of a sudden oil's at 75, you know, I think. And people are, if you go back before the weekend and all the stuff is like, okay, this is bombing goals that we're talking, people are throwing $100, $120 out. Mm-hmm. And now it seems like we're down 10%. We're back in the mid 60s. It seems like a yeah. distant memory. But that if it does go up for whatever reason, I think that is certainly something that is mm-hmm. very problematic for the stock market.
Yeah. All right. We'll move on to another one, another hot button, but this Perplexity AI. Have you guys been reading up on any of this?
Mm-hmm.
Internal discussions at Apple potentially to buy them out. Meta has actually met with them at a potential purchase, but it's basically an AI search engine that's, so this is according to AI, this is what
AI according to AI.
Yeah, so wow. Perplexity AI, the distinguishing thing is it's not a traditional search engine, but it offers concise, summarized answers based on real-time web searches and various AI models rather than just a list of links. So it's more tailored to what you're looking for, I guess. Mm-hmm. But they're the last valuation as of May 2025 was $14 billion. So it doesn't seem like, despite everything going on, consumer weakness, geopolitical risk, it doesn't seem like AI interest investment is slowing down at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there anything that can slow AI down at this point?
I think we're still in the gold rush stage. It's because if you find the solution for, there'll be many solutions for different problems, but if you can find something that the everyday person, whether it's a search or other things that we're not even talking about, just making businesses fundamentally more efficient, it's going to be a home run. You see, we didn't talk about, you mentioned, but Meta's buying up a bunch of AI and they're throwing the huge billions and billions of dollars at mm-hmm. different projects. They put 49% into another company that does AI. And these are AI companies you never heard of. And it's just.
Well, so that actually brings up another question. So it's all the big guys that are just buying these, I'll call them little, but they're still worth 500 million, a billion. Like, are we ever going to have companies like an OpenAI again, or is the Apple, Meta, Amazon, Googles of the world just going to gobble up all of these little companies?
Mm-hmm. They got the wallet to do it. So it's a scale. I think Meta's got 70 billion of cash on their balance sheet. So yeah, it's like they generate so much. If you think this is the direction that the world's going and you need to have it, if you don't, you'll lose out. Why not overspend on $14 billion here, another 20? It's a big number, right? And I think that's.
But if you have $70 billion in cash, I mean, $14 billion is chump change.
That's what I'm saying. That's right. That's a big number for those companies. So they're probably overvalued. But if they actually can hit on whatever process or makes things more efficient, it's going to be a home run. It's going to be a game changer. And that's why these big guys. So it is, I think, a lot of large numbers. These guys are going to continue to win. I don't know what you guys' thoughts, Kyle or Lisa.
Yeah, I think to your point, I think it's like they have the money to do it. And I mean, for smaller companies, it's expensive and they might be backed anyways by a big boy, like we saw with OpenAI and Microsoft. I mean, there are issues there now and there's like a little breakup happening. but I can see that, whether back it up or buy it out later. But other than that, I do not really see a new like rising star who is really able to get into the ranks of the big boys by itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there can be something, I mean, not with the technology and innovation that is out there now. If there's something completely new and groundbreaking in the AI space, I can see that, but they'll probably get bought out anyways on the way there. But I think it's a game of the giants. As of now.
Yeah. Well, and as we're talking about tech and AI, there's also, switching gears a little bit, stable coins. So Circle IPO'd. So we actually had an IPO of a big tech company. I'll call them tech company. But I mean, just the appetite, I think, for this, whether it's AI, cryptocurrency, like the appetite just seems to be there for investors. Do you guys think that continues? Because like Circle, the IPO was initially set at $27 to $28 the night before. And then it opened up at $69 and is now at $222. And it's been on the market for, 2 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
So like, does this appetite continue? Or are we just starting to overpay for these things and create this, I don't want to call it a bubble, but are we making a bubble in these technologies?
Yeah, I think two things come to my mind on both of these. The first is, I think we talked, I don't know, a month or two ago about small cap IPOs. I think you and I were talking about that and how you're skipping that step, right? Yep. You're not, this is a great example of that for both of these items. And then the other would be the chart that you and I, Lisa, were talking about yesterday, talking about the percentage of equity investors, like assets held per household, is now the highest on record. It's 49% of U.S. households have equity exposure.
Hmm.
So if you look,
that's good.
It's great. Mm-hmm. 15 years ago, that number was half that, 25%. And in the 1960s and 70s, it was only 10%. So it's up five times since that point. So when you think about Circle or any of these other, you know, companies that are kind of these quote unquote unicorns, or, you know, it was like the next big thing, it does make me think the, you know, the retail money block, like the flows coming into it. And so I did look on Bloomberg for Circle, and it's like most of it's retail money.
Hmm.
So households, it's kind of that tandem, you know, movement between households are going in, they're saying, I don't really trust traditional asset managers, you know, traditional equity. I'm going to go for the next, the hot dot, the, I'm going to try and hit a home run and knock the cover off the ball. So I think there's a bunch of stuff going on, but those are the things that come into my mind.
Keith, any thoughts?
No, you covered it. I think it feels meme-like, but I don't, part of it, I think it's such a hot space that there's so much demand for it. So when you get an IPO that actually goes through, they're just gonna be buyers, whether it's retail, there'll be some institutional as well. I don't know how to value it, so we haven't bought it. I don't think I'd buy it at these levels either. So it's, but it's, there's just not enough of these companies coming public that there's so much demand that those dollars are just going to chase it. And so, but at some point in time, they do become meme-like, and they'll get chased to some level. It's just ridiculous. And all of a sudden people are like, wait, what do I own here?
Yeah. Well, I think it's, I think it's a bet on the future use case for Circle's product, right? So it's a stable coin. It's basically saying that the people who are buying it at these levels are basically saying that, yes, this thing's going to be bigger because we're only going to be using stable coins in the next 3 to 5 years, right?
Sure.
That's what I'm thinking, that these guys are, then you investors are buying it at these levels for.
But then you have other competition, right? You have MasterCard, Visa are talking stable coin stuff now, and the rails, and whether it's good or bad. Or so it's like there's, it could be other things that come, can maybe disruptive, or at least compete with it. That, so that's where you have to be careful on what you're paying for things.
Lisa, any last minute comments?
I think, I mean, IPOs can be very hyped and attract a lot of attraction usually. That was a little bit special, I would say. But I think it also came at the right point, right? We saw and we hear about stablecoin framework, regulation, broader adoption. Like big boys like Amazon, Walmart talking about it. At least, I mean, we are still away from that, but they're at least talking about introducing that in their payment systems, and that's a big thing. And then Circle IPO'd in the middle of it. So I think it was the really right timing. I think if that would have been a year ago, everyone was like, yeah, what is that, right? Maybe it would have not taken off that much, but I think it was, everything was the right timing.
Sure.
And also I think it's the largest crypto related newish thing that IPO'd in the last couple of months. So that is also a new kind of frenzy there.
Yeah.
Outside of Bitcoin, something else, another crypto thing. So all of that I think was future technology, and the hope that it will take off and kind of be bigger down the road. But also I think a lot of it has to do with timing. That was perfect for that.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, good discussion. We'll leave it there. So if you like what you hear, like and subscribe, and we'll see you guys next week.